right, welcome, folks, to episode 3,475 of the Survival Podcast. You know what that means? 25 episodes away from episode 3,500. I don't know how many podcasts are out there. They're continuously running with 3,500 plus episodes, so that'll be a landmark episode for us. I don't really have anything planned for it, like we've done some landmark episodes with Collins and stuff, but it just is an interesting thing to note. I don't know. I guess I like patterns and round numbers and stuff. Anyway, what are we going to talk about today? I'm going to do a show I've been kind of threatening to do for, three or four weeks now? A show on great thinkers and quotes by great thinkers and theories by great thinkers that help us really understand the world that we live in today and the futility of the way most people spend their existence versus the proactive way that impactful people spend their existence. And I'm going to start out with a story today before we do our sponsor segment that'll set the mood for today's show. I read a book a long time ago. I don't even remember what the book was, but I know it was kind of a book when I was in my marketing and sales career, and it was on selling and building networks. I know it was that. It might have been by Harvey McKay or something like that. But in that book, he talks about how you'll see a fly, and that fly will end up in a windowsill. And the fly does not comprehend glass. There's really nothing quite like glass in nature. Why would a fly understand glass? I mean, glass is an invention of mankind. The closest thing we have is water, and it behaves entirely different, even though it may cause a reflection. So the fly ends up somehow in the house. He was born there, or he gets in the door, and he sees light, and he wants out. So he goes to the window, and he'll spend his entire remaining existence trying as hard as he can to get through that invisible barrier that we think of as glass. Now, to that fly, that glass is so impenetrable. It might as well be like, for a human, a double-layer force field, you know, on Star Trek, or a foot-thick piece of transparent aluminum, right? You're not getting through it. But you would think a human would assess that situation really quick and say, hey, wait, there's nothing behind me. I got in here. The way I came in is probably the way that I should get out. But no, not the fly. What does the fly do? The fly tries harder and harder and harder. And it isn't that the fly doesn't have a work ethic, right? You see people all the time, well, this person works really hard and they have nothing. Yeah, but what are they working at doing? What is the fly working at doing? To try to push his little fly body through the window. And it is so captive to the fly. The fly so doesn't understand it that odds are if you don't do anything at all, if you don't kill the fly or let the fly go, you'll come back in a day or two and laying on the windowsill, legs up and stiff, will be that fly dead. He will expend every bit of her life energy trying to get through that window. And while flies aren't long lived, the fly will die younger, not older, than if it had not tried so hard. But it can't see that what it's looking at is actually a barrier, immovable as a barrier. My show today is to try to link into you that there are certain constants in the human condition that go back as long as recorded time and certainly prior to recorded time. We just don't have a record of it, but we can look at everything from recorded time forward and go, these things in general do not change. Unless somebody radically changes them, and usually from the outside, not the inside. And as soon as you understand that, your life gets so much more simple, and you stop wasting your dash. Because what most people spend their time and their energy on is futility. You know, I'm going to watch the news so that the world won't, what? You think because you know what they told you, you have an impact? Or I'm going to vote harder, or, you know, I'm going to get involved and fix this thing, when the people who have always fixed things just kind of went over there and fixed it. And they did their own thing. And if their solution was good enough, eventually others flocked to it. It's almost never been done from inside. And there are certain constants of things like nepotism and favoritism and classism that have existed for as long as humans have. It's not something new. It's not new that we have class and caste systems. It's an ancient thing. it's not new that one group of people would enslave another group of people. It's as old as time. And what actually got rid of slavery was, no matter what that people tried to tell you, is that slavery became inefficient. There were better ways to do things than have classic slavery, like having, you know, blind slavery, where people think they're free when they're not. That's not a quote we're going to talk about today, but none are more enslaved than those who falsely believe themselves to be free, right? So we're going to talk about all that and more. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our two sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is the Exit and Build Land Summit through Live Free Academy. That's John Bush. And I really do love John. I think John does just a great job with so many things. And you can come on down to Bastrop to one of the best run events that I've ever had the privilege of being part of. And you can learn so much from so many people. And what I want to tell you is there's a lot of great speakers, me included, right? I'm going to be there. You can hear from me. But it's not just the speakers like John Bush and Joel Salatin, his wife Rebecca, myself, Nicole Sauce, like Derek Brose, Molly Englehart. Like, this is some great people to learn from about how to do more with what you have and how to get out of the cities and network with people if you're still stuck in the cities. But let me tell you what else is cool about it. The 500-odd people that will be around you who are all there for a common ideal. It is one of the best networking opportunities that you will ever get going down to Bastrop for this. And you get to hang out with me. It'll be cool. And, you know, Matt Powers will be there. He's an awesome dude. I think you'll enjoy meeting him. David Holgram will be presenting, co-founder of Permaculture. Actually, you'll hear about him a little bit today when we get into actually a quote by Buckminster Fuller that David paraphrased, whether he knew it or not. I have no idea. I'd love to meet him, but that's the one we'll have to get virtually there. Everybody else you can meet, you know, shake hands with, et cetera, and really consider upgrading if you come on down and get the VIP package where you get everything. And it's just going to be an awesome event because it always is. I say no to most events during this time of year because I'm so busy. You know, John does such a great job that I try to say yes to him, and it's also a 3-hour drive for me. So, hey, come on down, especially if you've never been before. Next up today, the Wealth Steading Podcast with John Pugliano. You know, Thinking Beyond Money Market Funds is his latest episode. You definitely want to check out John's podcast. It's straight, direct, to the point. None of the episodes are very long, but hey, you know what John's heading for? He's heading for a landmark episode. He's not there yet, but he's on as close to it. Episode 445, that means John Pugliano has been podcasting long enough. He's about to hit 500 episodes. That's pretty awesome. And he is a great guy. He has been a member of this community for a very long time. He's a prepper himself, a ham radio operator. He knows all about gardens and guns and everything else. And he's an incredible investment manager. So you definitely want to check out his podcast and his other services. You can learn more at wealthsteading.com, where you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. With that, let's go ahead and get on into this. And I want to kind of start out with a little bit more to set the stage for these 10 visionaries, these 10 thinkers that we're going to talk about today. And I want to start off with something I kind of alluded to during my intro. There's certain constants in the human condition. And one of the greatest deceptions that's been perpetrated upon people in the modern world is that we think a lot of things that are, you know, going on right now are new. We also think that a lot of things that, you know, are not new, but they were around a couple hundred years ago, are something that was created about the time that we hear about them in history. Things like slavery, for instance, which I won't go deep into today, but it's just a good example that slavery was with us since, well, the dawn of humanity and forming communities and having oppositional forces and one force overcoming another force and saying, instead of killing all these people, we'll put them to work for us. They can accept slavery or they can die. And that can, and there's literally not a civilization that didn't have slavery at some time in its history, including all the benevolent Native American societies had forms of slavery. Native Americans literally sold some of their own into slavery to European settlers. It's actually an odd thing that slavery itself was very common from Virginia South among natives and not very common from Virginia North. Kind of weird, kind of like right where that Mason-Dixon thing is, almost like the land itself dictated where places made a lot of sense to have slavery. And, you know, in the North, they would have either no slavery or things that were more like indentured servitude rather than classical slavery. In fact, because I read 1491, America Before Columbus, which also covers a lot of initial, like, first contact, I can tell you that not only did some of the native societies sell their own people to Europeans, in some cases, monarchs of these little city-states gave slaves to early explorers. Like, and I'm not saying that justifies it. I'm just saying, so all that was going on here in North America, completely untouched by European settlement, but we're kind of conditioned to believe that, like, the whole slavery thing was just the African slave trade and the evil white supremacists that started the country that we call the United States today. It was a constant in society that evolved out because it stopped being efficient. That's why. I'd love to tell you it was because of morality, and I would certainly say that slavery is inherently immoral. But that's not why we barely have. We still have slavery in the world today, whether you believe that or not. But, and I'm not talking about tax slavery or anything. I'm not talking about some nuance to it. I'm saying we have straight up, this person owns this person and can sell them to another person. And in some places, like out in the open. But mostly it's gone because it's inherently inefficient. You have to clothe, house, and feed your slave where you can, you know, from an institutional level, you can have your slave pay a tribute. So we evolved out of that particular thing. But the other thing that I learned when I read 1491 was how much, for instance, in what is today Mexico and Central America and the northern part of South America, how much many of the tribes like the Aztec, the Inca, the Mexica, et cetera, the stories of conquest, expansion, and collapse, the stories of brother killing brother, like all the shit you hear about, like the Greek or Roman empires, exact same shit. Total different culture, total different place, different nuance to it, exact same shit. Brother and brother both are going to be king. The eldest brother is in line to the throne. The younger brother kills the older brother. The younger brother kills the father and then kills the older brother, right? And then the cousin comes in and kills the younger brother, and then all the women get together and say the cousin is the guy that should run things. Right. Like all of the drama, all of the deception, all of the inherent evil and much of the inherent good of humanity was everywhere. And so if that's the case, then you need to realize there's old quote, right? Nothing new under the sun. The way humans behave is intrinsic to the human characteristic. And what we're always striving to do is rise above the basal instincts and become what we think of as more civilized. I actually think what we're trying to do is become more human. That we are a species that is still evolving, not just physically, but spiritually, mentally, and intellectually. And we're struggling with that change, and we've been struggling with that change a long time. And it'd be great if more of us would get on board with doing it consciously, but it ain't gonna happen. So we need to do our thing and accept that the world is what it is at the same time. That seems hard, but hopefully it won't by the end of that. Because what I really want you to take from this, I'm going to give you these 10 thinkers and their theory or what they said or what they did. But what I want you to take more than anything else from all of it, as mixed as it's going to be, you can change your thoughts. You can change your behaviors. You can change your efforts, but you cannot do it for others. There is nothing I can do. I have a pretty big influence in the world with this podcast. Been doing it 16 years. This June, it'll be 16 years. I've had, you know, millions of people probably over the years that came and went that have heard my voice, listened to it, and went and did something. But none of you and none of them who have come and gone are anybody that I actually controlled how you thought or how you behaved or where you put your efforts. In the end, the person hearing new information has to make that choice for themselves. And we can be an influence, positive or negative, to others, but we do not control them. We don't have a Neuralink chimp like Elon. I can't sit back here and go, I'm going to make anyone can golf be better at his job or worse at his job or treat his wife better or be mean to his wife, right? Like, anyone can golf who's here in the live chat, so I'm picking on him. He has to make those decisions for himself, assuming he is a he. If you're a Z, oh well. Okay. Anyway, let's start off with, and this is probably one of the most important ones that we'll cover today from the standpoint of what I was just talking about, The Iron Law of Bureaucracy by Jerry Pournelle. And if you've never heard me talk about this, I'm just going to read, as was written, Pournelle's thoughts on the Iron Law. This was originally written September 11th, 2010. First, there will be those who are devoted to the goals of the organization. Examples are the dedicated classroom teachers in an educational bureaucracy, many of the engineers and launch technicians and scientists at NASA, even some of the agricultural scientists and advisors in the former Soviet Union Collective Farming Administration. Secondly, there will be those dedicated to the organization itself. Examples are many. The administrators in the education system, many professors of education, many teachers, union officials, and much of the NASA headquarters staff, etc. The Iron Law states that in every case, the second group will gain control and keep control of the organization. It will write the rules and control promotions within the organization. Now, that's pretty much a bummer, right? I don't know how else you want to put it. Like, it's not very encouraging if you're somebody that seeks to make change, but it is if you accept it. If you accept it, then you realize there is no point in, let's say, joining the FBI to fix the problem. Right? That's not going to fix the problem, right? Or becoming a teacher to fix education, it's not going to fix the problem. Becoming a doctor to fix the problems in medicine. I think doctors can fix the problems in medicine. But if the doctor becomes a doctor, enters the existing system, and thinks he's going to change it by being a really great ER physician like one on TV, guess what? That shit is not going to work. And the place that I was at when I discovered Pournelle's theory was actually at an inflection point within trying to understand what the hell was going on in permaculture. This was about 10 years ago. A whole group of what we'll call the purple people in permaculture, the hippie dippies, the left-wing loons, were trying to take it over. And they were trying to take it over in a very inept way. They were going to create their own certification because the one created by the founder wasn't good enough anymore. And they had all these rules for what it took to become certified as a permaculture practitioner that read a lot like a college, you know, curriculum or something like that, instead of the intensive, you know, 80-hour course that Mollison put people through and taught others to do the same, so that they could form that foundation and then go out and actually do things and learn from doing the things with the design science background, right? That's how it was designed. But they wanted to change it. And I realized exactly what I was looking at when I read Pournelle's Iron Law. Permaculture broke it. You would think the Iron Law cannot be broken, but what you have to do is create an organization, a concept devoid of the second group. In the words of Bill Mollison, no politicians, administrators, or priests. That's what Bill said. Nobody's in charge, not even me. Not me, not David, no one's in charge. And the reason these people were trying to change it is they were all administrators. They were all bureaucrats. They were all politicians. They were all priests. Maybe not in professional title, but they were all of that mindset. They wanted to be able to control the concept rather than do the work. And every time you get a large company, a large consortium, a large industrial complex, and certainly a government bureaucracy, you will get this. If there is an ability for the organization to be controlled, it will be controlled. And who will control it? Who controls these organizations? Think about a police department. Do you know how many cops, as shitty as the job can be, they actually like being cops. They like being in their community. They like talking to people. They like helping people because, believe it or not, cops actually help people. Some don't. A lot do. And a lot go out of their way to try to help people. And those are the ones that always are turning down promotions. They end up promoted toward the end of their career against their will because if they don't, they're going to get thrown out. They don't want to be a chief. They don't want to be a lieutenant. They don't want to be a captain. They don't want to work behind a desk. They don't want to tell other people what to do. They want to go out and do the job they signed up for, their missions, right? That's what I call them. I call them missions. And then you have bureaucrats. Now, if you have somebody who desperately wants advancement at all cost, who's willing to kiss ass, right, to wear out the knee pads in doing so, and will take every step necessary to advance in an organization, and someone who's better but doesn't want it, who's going to end up rising to the top of that organization? The one trying to. The people trying to will always be manipulators and controllers that are more concerned about personal advancement, power and control, than the thing that the entity is supposed to be doing. Right? It's in every place. Like, I use cops because there's kind of a hierarchy there that's visible. But Hunter says, I'm super happy at sergeant foreman level, right? It's the same thing. How many places are there where, like, guys go work in factories or something, and, like, they can become a line supervisor, and there's a shitload of people, they don't want to do it. But what they really don't want to do is become, like, the union rep or some shit. The starry-eyed idiot that doesn't know yet how the iron law works might go take a shot at it, but in the end, the cutthroat who desires power will always push him out. Once you get this, you can just stop. You can just stop thinking you're going to fix an organization by entering it. The only way that you'll get power and control is to become one of the things that you hate. This, if you accept this iron law for what it is, then you understand a lot of things about how to make your life better, which is stay out of systems like that, build outside of systems like that, be the example on the outside, and we're going to talk more about that here in a second. But it's also like, don't get frustrated with things that you don't have any power or control over. Look for what you do. So moving on, this one, I'm going to actually just play this video. I've played it before. It's about 5 minutes long. I'm going to play most of it. We're moving on to Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a minister and a writer in Germany at the time that the Nazis rose to power. He was thrown in prison at the very beginning of the war and died just before it ended in a concentration camp. And he came up with something called the theory of stupidity. And rather than explain it again, I'm going to go ahead and I'm just going to let this little short video here from Sprouts explain it for me.
In the darkest chapter of German history, during a time when incited mobs threw stones into the windows of innocent shop owners and women and children were cruelly humiliated in the open, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a young pastor, began to speak publicly against the atrocities that the regime had produced. After years of trying to change people's minds, Dietrich Bonhoeffer came home one evening and his own father had to tell him that two men were waiting in his room to take him away. In prison, Bonhoeffer began to reflect on how his country of poets and thinkers had turned into a collective of cowards, crooks, and criminals. Eventually, he concluded that the root of the problem was not malice, but stupidity. In his famous Letters from Prison, Bonhoeffer argued that stupidity is a more dangerous enemy of the good than malice, because while one may protest against evil, it can be exposed and prevented by the use of force. Against stupidity, we are defenseless. Neither protests nor the use of force accomplish anything here. Reasons fall on deaf ears. Facts that contradict a stupid person's prejudgment simply need not be believed, and when they are irrefutable, they are just pushed aside as inconsequential, as incidental. In all this, the stupid person is self-satisfied and, being easily irritated, becomes dangerous by going on the attack. For that reason, greater caution is called for when dealing with a stupid person than with a malicious one. If we want to know how to get the better of stupidity, we must seek to understand its nature. This much is certain. Stupidity is, in essence, not an intellectual defect, but a moral one. There are human beings who are remarkably agile intellectually, yet stupid, and others who are intellectually dull, yet anything but stupid. The impression one gains is not so much that stupidity is a congenital defect, but that, under certain circumstances, people are made stupid, or rather, they allow this to happen to them. people who live in solitude manifest this defect less frequently than individuals in groups, and so it would seem that stupidity is perhaps less a psychological than a sociological problem. It becomes apparent that every strong upsurge of power, be it of a political or religious nature, infects a large part of humankind with stupidity, almost as if this is a sociological-psychological law where the power of the one needs the stupidity of the other. The process at work here is not that particular human capacities such as intellect suddenly fail. Instead, it seems that under the overwhelming impact of rising power, humans are deprived of their inner independence and, more or less consciously, give up an autonomous position. The fact that the stupid person is often stubborn must not blind us from the fact that he is not independent. In conversation with him, one virtually feels that one is dealing not at all with him as a person, but with slogans, catchwords, and the like that have taken possession of him.
All right, I'm going to call it there if you want to watch the rest of the video, which is excellent. You certainly can. But what that should have invoked for you, didn't you just watch that happen a few years ago with COVID? Didn't you? Catchphrases, et cetera. But haven't you seen it for wars? Freedom isn't free! Statement is true, but it doesn't mean that we're justified in inaction, right? Like a 20-year war that wasted trillion-plus dollars cost thousands of American lives, hundreds of thousands of lives of people that never did anything to you, and wrecked the lives of so many that came home not whole, but it was all done with some catchphrases. Because we've created this tribal nonsense that it's left versus right, and whatever your side says because of this collective mindset, well, you have to justify it. And the more times you say a thing, no matter how stupid it is, the harder it is for you to say, I was wrong, and change your mind. The theory of stupidity explains so much about why you feel like you're not normal. See, most of the people that listen to a show like this for any length of time, I'm talking about people that tune in for one episode because it's about something they liked. People that become subscribers of a show like mine or many other independent media enterprises, they're generally independent thinkers, or they would not be outside of what we consider the mainstream. And when I say mainstream, I'm talking about, you know, the people that are doing podcasts, but they're basically like the podcast version of CNN or MSNBC or the podcast version of Newsmax and Fox News. I'm not counting them. I'm talking about people that if you listen to people who one group of people will call them libtards and the other group of people for saying the same thing will say that they're ultra MAGA extremist white supremacists, then you're an independent thinker. Because that's a ridiculous thing. The person cannot be both. But the theory of stupidity explains why people take them as being the other side. People like you. I'm tired of people like you. You Donald Trump loving. You know, and I get that all the time. Why? Because I said this was stupid and your side did it? And you can't accept that your side is stupid. The other side must be stupid. That's the real key to the theory of stupidity. We get people to behave in a stupid manner, but we convince them that everybody not doing what they're doing is really the group of people behaving in a stupid manner. And often, both sides are behaving in a stupid manner, and then you have perfect division. The big difference between what Bonhoeffer observed in Germany, Germany made a very concise goal to get everybody on one side or kill them or make them run away or hide. The United States is a more sophisticated mechanism of control than just about any that's ever existed in history, and our masters have realized that's bad. That if you get one side unilaterally in control on this false dichotomy for long enough, people explode because they don't have the illusion of choice. But if you can divide a society roughly 50-50 in complete opposition to each other, you can get away with that whatever the fuck you want. That's the theory of stupidity modified from the time of fascist Nazi Germany to the time of fascist United States of America in modern times. And I know some of you get really mad when I say this country's fascist, but it is. I'm speaking of economic control. I'm not speaking of putting people in concentration camps, though we've gotten kind of close to that a few times. We have. We have a lot of rhetoric like that, but the overriding thing is we must keep people stupid, or they will think for themselves and be autonomous, and therefore they cannot be modern day slaves. So when you realize this is what's going on, you stop bothering trying to convince your brother-in-law, who has fallen to the theory of stupidity, that, you know, hey, you know, bro, like, here's what's really going on, and you start focusing on things that actually, you know, matter and actually can be controlled. And that leads us to one of my favorite thinkers of all time, Buckminster Fuller. And Buckminster Fuller, I think my favorite quote by him is this: you never change things. By fighting the existing reality to change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. Now, there's a lot of the thing is, that's all true, but it's not simple to do. We absolutely have houses that are better than anything that we build today, as a matter of course. Things, and it's all over the map, right? It's things like Earthships are, especially in the right climate, they are such a better living environment than our typical stick and brick. How do we prevent this wonderful idea over here from disrupting the existing paradigm? Well, you make sure nobody can get a mortgage, for one. You make sure that it violates codes and regulations, because where are we back to now? Iron law bureaucracy, right? So the entire purpose, and we'll get to this in a second too with a different thinker, the entire purpose of all of these, like, urban planning, urban development, codes, building codes, was to make housing safer and more affordable. That was the entire idea in the beginning. We're going to talk about Stafford beer, don't worry. But we've lost that now. Now we have things being held back. But what we can do is we can do it anyway. We can build our own systems anyway, our own systems that are parallel to the existing system, and it's really the only way forward. What I thought of, though, when I was putting this list together today, and I do have some permaculturists on today's list, Bill Mollison and Jeff Lawton, but co-founder David Holmgren, he has a quote that I've used in previous presentations that is almost identical, but it's not. It's the same but different, man, in the words of Tommy Chong. Let's take a look at that quote right now. And I have it highlighted on the screen if you're on the video. Here's what he said about permaculture. As a social movement, permaculture originated in the counterculture, applying an activist strategy to create a world we wanted rather than fighting to stop the world we didn't want. So it's the 1970s. There's a lot of protesting in the streets still going on. The civil rights protests are recently in the rearview mirror. We had just gotten to the point where we realized we were going to extract ourselves from the Vietnam War. And this was a worldwide issue. Like, there was a lot of people who wanted the U.S. out of Vietnam that weren't Americans. And in America, almost everybody knew somebody that was a Vietnam vet. So there was a lot of social movement. And the entirety of the social movement being built around Bonhoeffer's theory of stupidity was fight the system. Go out and hold up a sign that says they're wrong, because that'll do something good, right? But what Mollison and Holmgren did was say, what if we just write a blueprint to solve problems, put it out in the world, and let people that want it use it? And then old man Mollison, right, he was the genius that said the universities can never get their hands on this. That was he had taught in the university system. He was actually a professor at a university in Australia when he and David was like his intern, his research assistant. When they put this together, and David brought it to Bill and said, I think we're onto something here, and they put this together, Bill said if the universities get their hands on this, they'll destroy it. And they basically trademarked the term and then made it open source so that no one could control it. That's how permaculture broke the iron law. They accepted Bonhoeffer's theory of stupidity, and they understood Pornell's iron law. And I don't even think the iron law had been written yet. Right. Because, like I said, I read that 2010. I think Pornell actually said that. Jerry Pornell said that prior to 2010. But that's when that entry was. But I still don't think Pornell's iron law had been codified at the time that Mollison and Holmgren were putting together permaculture and made this decision specifically. And this is why it's important. Yes, I'm giving you these people credited with these thoughts today. They've been had hundreds of times by hundreds of people, at least many thousands of times by tens of thousands of people, and stated in many different ways. And that's why I brought David into this one, right? That he's basically stating the same thing that Buckminster was stating, right? I don't think it was intentional, though. I don't think it's like, I'm going to plagiarize this thing. I think it was just, this is the way, right? This is the way. So moving on, let's talk about another person you've probably heard of quite a bit in your life, Michael Crichton. Yes, that Michael Crichton, the Michael Crichton that wrote Jurassic Park, Prey, and a bunch of other really interesting science fiction novels. He's also the creator of the TV series, one of the most successful TV series of the 80s, 90s period, ER. And a lot of people, I don't think, realize that he's both the author behind Jurassic Park, one of the most successful film franchises in the world, and ER, an incredibly successful television franchise. But this guy was a thinker, and he's the person that came up with the term Gelman amnesia, the Gelman amnesia effect. And for those not in the video, Gell, G-E-L-L hyphen M-A-N-N, amnesia. Why he came up with that term, I don't know, but let's talk about what Gelman amnesia is. Briefly stated, the Gelman amnesia effect is as follows. You open the newspaper to an article on some subject you know well. In Murray's case, physics. In mine, show business. You read the article and see the journalist has absolutely no understanding of either the facts or the real issues. Often the article is so wrong, it actually presents the story backwards, reversing cause and effect. I call these wet streets cause rain stories. Get that again. Wet streets cause rain. When you're informed about a subject and you read something written by a journalist who's not, you often feel like that's what they said. The roads were wet today and that caused the terrain. That backwards, right? Papers are full of them. In any case, you read with exasperation or amusement the multiple errors in a story. Then you turn the page to a national or international affairs and read it as if the rest of the newspaper was somehow more accurate about Palestine. That's interesting, isn't it, that he was invoking that all the way? See, nothing changes. Palestine than the baloney you just read. You turn the page and forget what you know. Michael Crichton, who was with us from 1942 to 2008. So let's break that one down a bit, though I think it pretty much does speak for itself. This is exactly what happens all the time in modern society, especially with people debating each other and screaming at each other and calling each other names and all. But I saw it on TV, and the other person's like, well, you're an idiot. But the same person that says just because it was on TV doesn't mean it's true will turn around and say the same thing about an issue when it matches their perception bias. You forgot what you knew. What we should all know by now, the government, the media, and all the bureaucracies assorted from the government and the non-governmental organizations that all work in this come all together are to never be trusted to be correct about anything. And I promise you, if you know something really well, not because the TV told you, not because you were trained to believe what the system says, if you've independently developed a knowledge of anything, and you go out and you look for articles about it, not independent people speaking about it in a seminar, right, where they're being actually honest. If you go read the articles written by journalists about the thing you know, you'll be like, wrong, 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 wrong. But then you turn the page and you read an article on Putin's almost out of bullets. And a guy like Jack Spirko says, this is stupid. Russia is the single largest manufacturer of weapons in the world. They are not running out of bullets, and this is bullshit. And then you write Jack an email and tell him what a dickhead he is, and he's a tool of Putin and whatever, because he just gave you facts that were contrary to what you were told. But here we are 18 months later, and gee, he's not out of bullets yet, is he? You see how that works? Like, you should know that when CNN and Fox News are singing from the same sheet of music, it's a lie. It doesn't mean they can't both say something totally different. Both of them be lies. But when they are together, when you have usually disparaged sources saying the same thing and something doesn't seem right, it's a lie. It's a lie, and everybody that is independently thinking knows that it's a lie. And the only way this works And this is why the word amnesia is perfect for this theory, is that you forget what you knew. Is this source trustworthy on everything? No, if they're not trustworthy on everything, they're not trustworthy on anything. It doesn't mean that they will never tell you the truth. It doesn't mean they will never report the facts. What it means is the facts will always be stacked towards an agenda, and many of the facts will not be facts. They will be opinions and presented as facts, and many of the opinions presented as facts will also be equally wrong. Like, here's an example. I know an awful lot about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. It is almost impossible for me to read an article written by a journalist, let's say at Forbes or something, without going wrong. Yeah, but you got it out of context, right? Or those of you that were in the military, tell me you don't do this, right? There's a movie, guys in uniform, class A's, right? Got all his like medals and shit. Don't you like, that's in the wrong place. Nobody would have those two things at the same time, right? Gig line wrong, whatever, right? Because you know what it's supposed to look like. And tell me you don't do this. Yeah, man, they got somebody with some military experience to put that uniform together for that actor. Like, that's correct. That's correct to the time and the place and the situation. The rank's right. Everything else is right. Or you go, wow, the way that guy moves, he moves like a soldier. And I don't mean combat. I mean, like, the crispness and things, right? Just the general way people walk, right? Because you know what you're looking for. But the average simpleton is like, oh, who it is. It's a bullet clip, right? And they, oh, wow, bullet clips, those are dangerous, right? I mean, but this is the important part of Gelman amnesia. You don't know everything, and neither do I. You cannot rely upon a source to be telling you the truth about something you don't know anything about, ever. Because the fact that every time you do know, they're wrong, at least on some level, and usually some critical, important level, then you know they can't be trusted, but we do. So this goes right in with, like, I put these in order for a reason. Like, this locks into the theory of stupidity. Those who cannot comprehend what Gelman amnesia and break from it will fall victim to the theory of stupidity. And when you're dealing with people who don't understand Gelman amnesia, you're dealing with somebody who has fallen into the theory of stupidity's duress, right? You're not going to get them out of it until they're ready. Very important to understand, and you'll stop pushing strings, right? So many people, they live their lives, I describe it this way, you're trying to push a wet string through a pile of cow shit, and that's, you're getting as much result as you should expect from that exercise. The string's never going in there, it's certainly never going through, and all you're going to get is shit all over your hands. But yet people live this way because they don't understand these things that we're talking about today. Yeah, Hunter says, laugh out loud, salutes. That's what I'm talking about, right? You've seen it. The guy salutes and you're like, dude was either in the military or they had a good advisor from the military that worked with that guy and taught him how to salute properly. Or you're like, what a bunch of stupid asses. Like, this is nothing like reality. This guy has no military bearing whatsoever. I remember the first time I ever noticed that, I was pretty young, and there was a movie, I can't remember what it was called now, but I think it was Gregory Hines and Danny DeVito in it, and Danny DeVito was like this teacher helping the slow kids that were in basic training or whatever, and I think it was Gregory Hines. The way the guy moved, the way his uniform was on, I'm like, dude, I think that guy worked with my drill sergeant Arroyo, man. He even looked, they had the same very similar look to the way the mustache was trimmed and all. But he was dead spot on with the way he behaved, with the knife hand and everything else, right? And so you notice it when you know what to look for. And you don't see the problem when you don't know what to look for. So why did most people believe the bullshit that Tony Fauci spewed out about a bad cold? Because they didn't know anything. And they didn't bother to learn anything. So this is why it doesn't work. This is why, as much as I tried to educate this audience, anybody outside of it just thought I was a loon. Even though, like, everything I said now has just basically been exactly the way that it was. Because I research, well, what is an mRNA virus? How does it replicate? Is there any known science that shuts down replication of mRNA viruses? Well, you're not a virologist. Yeah, but I can read and I can understand and I can go outside this bullshit they're telling you with this. Like, how many things look stupid now that you know what to look for? How about the running death counter? Remember the running death counters? Oh, my God! Hide! Run! Fill the toilet paper for it and buy water. We don't know why. And everybody did. And everybody did. Why? Gelman amnesia. Next, this is one I really wish we would learn it. We're not gonna. Sun Tzu, author of The Art of War. Probably the most impactful thing this man ever wrote, said, put down for history, that we could learn from today. No nation benefits from a prolonged war. Ever. You might think that's not true because of how addicted to war the military-industrial complex and our government and bureaucracies are, because it makes people lots of money. That doesn't mean the nation benefits. What benefit did the United States obtain from 20 years of prolonged war in Iraq and Afghanistan? Give me one benefit. No, don't tell me BlackRock made money or Halliburton made money or Dick Cheney made money. That America gained as a benefit. How is the life of a single everyday American citizen better for 20 years of prolonged warfare in a part of the world that most people, even today, could not show you on a globe if you took the labels off the countries? They couldn't point to where Iraq and Afghanistan are, including the ones with the foam fingers saying we're number one that rah-rahed the whole thing. Are our soldiers better for it? Are soldiers, some who spent 3, 4, 5 tours, are they better for it? Does the guy that works at a factory making cars, is his life better because of it? No. Nobody benefited. Iraq certainly didn't benefit. As shitty of a person as Saddam Hussein was, the life of the average Iraqi today is worse than it was before that war started. And you want to talk about complete control by the Taliban, right, where they had mostly control, not complete and total lockdown control, and a whole shitload of America's weapons. The average Afghani has not benefited from this. Their life is not better. That's what Sun Tzu was saying, that the nation itself, no matter how much of a leader can be a dictator, a military junta, whatever, there are really two types of people that run countries. And there's only two. And there's shades of gray between the two extremes. But there are those that focus most on the needs of the people who they view themselves as serving and leading, and those who focus on what benefits them. And guess what most of them are? Well, most of them focus on what benefits them because the iron law of bureaucracy says to get into that position, you have to be that cutthroat son of a bitch that funnels your way up to that position of power so that you can control the organization itself rather than the mission. Because what is the mission? What is the mission of a government? To protect the lives of its people, to preserve the life and liberty of its people, and to stand for defense of its people. It's not what it does, but that's what it's supposed to do. We'll get to that. But no nation has ever benefited from a protracted war. And now we'll get to the next piece. We'll drop the next shoe. Stafford Beer stated the purpose of a system is what it does, not what it claims to do. In fact, he observed there is no point in claiming the purpose of a system is to do what it constantly fails to do. Stafford Beer. When people tell me what the current public education system is supposed to do, I say, but it doesn't do that. And then they tell me how we can fix it. And I ask them how old it is. And then they look at you like you have a lizard crawling out of your ear. They have no idea what you're asking. How long have we had the current system of education that we have today? And because we have computers in the classroom now, they'll say, well, that kind of started in like the year 2000. But no, the system's the same. How old is the system? Many of you in the audience know, because you're informed individuals who are free thinkers and research things. It's from the late 1800s. It's a Prussian system of education that was developed in what is today Germany and was brought to America so that we could train people to be smart enough to stand in an assembly line and still dumb enough to not question authority. We created a hierarchical system in education that segmented the population into managerial class and worker class. And there's a small amount of room for the managerial class, so colleges and universities were quite exclusive at the time. And most people, all they have is a high school education, if they had that. And that system is over 100 years old. So if it ain't fixed yet, exactly when is it going to get fixed? When your side gets elected? Your side's been elected. No matter what side you're on, your side has had complete and total control at one point in history. And the other side has had complete and total control at another point in history. And there's been divided control at most of the points in history. And the problem's not fixed. Why would you think it's going to be? See, Gelman amnesia. You forgot what you knew. You know this. I'm not telling you anything you don't know right now. You know that that's the case. If you're my age, you're 50 years old or older, you have seen at the federal level complete and total control by the Republicans, complete and total control by the Democrats, and various forms of split government. You know you've seen that. So if either side had all the power, you know, we would fix everything. You know that's a lie, but yet you continue to believe that we can fix things that cannot be fixed. You continue to believe that the purpose of a system is what it claims to do versus what it does. Do you know how easy your life gets once you accept this? A person who thinks they can fix the educational system is the parent that goes to the PTA meetings and the school board meetings and stands up for their kids and tries to change the curriculum and gets threatened by the Department of Justice and labeled a domestic terrorist. The person that accepts that this is the case, that says the purpose of the system is what it does and I don't like what it's doing to my children, and that's the its purpose is to do what it's doing that I don't want it to do, then I will take my child out of the system. Bye. I will do the one thing that I can that actually has meaning here. I will deny the system access to my child and the money that comes with my child. And I know you're like, well, if I take my kid out of school, I still pay property tax, including the school tax portion of it and what have you. Yeah, that's true. But the school doesn't get the money. You understand that? Like schools, individual schools, the place you go, you know, Franklin Roosevelt Elementary or whatever. Yeah. Ronald Reagan High School. Right? Like those schools actually get their monetary allocation based on the number of asses in seats for at least X many days a year. That's why they're so tight on, attendance. Do you think they really care that your kid played hooky? No, they care if your kid plays hooky too much. They won't get money for that kid for that quarter or that semester. That's all they care about is money. Your kid's a dollar sign. So once I accept the purpose of the system is what it does, and I don't like what the system's doing, then I abstain from the system. It's just simple. Now, why would they not want you to think that way? How quickly would we actually fix these systems if people just pulled out of them? If 50% of people were homeschooling right now, I guarantee you public education would get better because it would go into survival mode. And survival mode is where it fixes its problems, except that it wouldn't. Except that it wouldn't. No, they would use because if you have guns, you will point them at people when you feel that you're losing. And the state has guns and the state has force. The purpose of the system is what it does. Think of any system out there that claims to do anything. What is supposed to be the purpose of the National Institute of Health, NIH, Anthony Fauci's former baby? Well, it was to research and develop cures for cancer, by the way, in case you didn't know that. When it was first formed and Anthony Fauci was first put in charge of it, that was its only mandate. It was dying because it was failing to do what it was set up to do. So he's like, I know, we'll get involved with viruses because they're sort of related to cancers. And it became this giant monolith, but it was supposed to protect patients and make sure that people got good medical advice. What does it do? It protects drug manufacturers, pharmacists, and controls the medical industry through the issuance of subsidies and grants. That's its purpose. Its purpose is what it does. It doesn't matter what the statement, it doesn't matter what the intention is. You have to think about it like a fire. What is the purpose of the system? It's what it does. How do you get a fire? We don't rubbing sticks. We're not doing Indian hand drills or some shit. Like, you have a lighter. How do you get a fire? If you walk up to a great big oak tree and hold a lighter up against it, the lighter will melt and your finger will burn off before you start the tree on fire. How do you make a fire? You get some tinder and some kindling and some larger stock. You light it from underneath. The airflow. The system does what the system does. Yeah? No matter if you are black or white or male or female or a Z or whatever. If you build a fire pyramid with tinder and kindling and dry material, if you build it the way it's designed and you put a flame to it, you will get a fire. The system doesn't care that my intention when I put all these things together was to make a rocket. It won't be a rocket. It'll just be a fire. It'll burn out and it'll be gone. And if you build it in the wrong place, it can burn down a whole county or a whole state. The purpose of the system is what it does. Start looking at every system that way. Do not ask what that system is supposed to do. Do not ask how that system is supposed to benefit anybody. Simply analyze it. What is the output of this? What do we get from it? That is its purpose. And the moment that you understand that, you'll start working like Buckminster Fuller and David Holgren would advise you outside the system. We're going to shift a little bit here to kind of a different mindset. We've kind of beat that up enough. I want to talk about people that you don't think of as giving you advice in certain areas. Paul Harvey, one of the best known voices in history. No one thinks of him as an agronomist, a horticulturist, a permaculturist, or an environmentalist. But he once said one of the most important statements that humans have ever uttered. Despite all our accomplishments, we owe our existence to a 6-inch layer of topsoil and the fact that it rains. Have you ever really thought about that? If you've heard that statement, had you really like meditated on it and understood the significance of something like that? The inherent impetus that should give you. If your existence is dependent upon a thing, shouldn't it be a priority? Let's put it a different way. You're locked in a room. There is a window. The window is also locked, but it's made of glass. There is a pipe capable of breaking the window. Otherwise, the room is airtight. You have a certain amount of oxygen, and at which point that you start building up the CO2, you will pass out, go to sleep, and die. Your existence is dependent upon opening the room to the outside air. The door is locked. It's made of steel. The walls are made of steel. The only weakness is the window. Someone said to you, whatever you do, don't break the window. And yet you're fully aware of it is the only way to save your life. How long do you sit there before you pick up the pipe and break the window? Do you wait till you start feeling lightheaded? Or do you say, fuck this, anybody that would put me inside a room like this and give me an out, I'm not going to sit here and die and break the window. Why? Because your existence depends on it. Well, you don't control the topsoil all over the planet. You certainly don't control the rain all over the planet, but you do control your own backyard. And if your existence is dependent upon this, you might want to learn a little bit about it. And then you've got to remember everything else we talked about. Oh, it's okay. They got all these smart people with degrees in agriculture, and they're going to feed us, and they're going to fix everything. The second you peel back the first layer of the onion as to what is happening to our arable land around the world, you realize Gelman amnesia all over again, man. And then you have to take the advice of Buckminster Fuller. You can't fix it. But anyone can farm. Whether it's full-on farming, like big time, whether it's a small market garden, or whether it's your garden in your backyard and you're farming for your family and your neighbor. But you owe your existence. This is why there's a lot of things I don't like about Elon Musk, and there's a lot of things that I do. I think he's an incredibly smart person, an incredibly ambitious person, and I think he's one of those unique individuals in history that does not understand the word no. And I actually have a friend who worked directly for Elon for a couple years. And I mean, high level, close to. And that's what he told me. The man does not understand what the word no means. I want this done, but we can't do it. His response will be, how much money do you need to do it? No, you don't understand. Like, we can't do this. Yes, you can. You need more people. You need more material. You need something. Tell me what it is. We'll get that, and we're going to do it. Right? I actually admire that. People like that drive humanity forward. But I'll tell you what, he's not dumb enough to actually think we're going to have a civilization on Mars in 20 years. How long has it taken us to go back and put a base on the moon? We're not even done yet. We haven't even done it yet. We're not even put another person back there yet. I know you moon conspiracy people are here. I don't care. I'm gonna ignore you today. I don't have time for you. I'm trying to get this done. There's an eclipse about to happen, and I want to go see it with my grandkids right in my own backyard. If those clouds stay out of here, it's going to look really cool. All right? But he knows that we're not going to have a civilization in 20 years. What's he doing when he says that we will? He's pitching a sales pitch. But you know why we won't? It doesn't rain on Mars, and there's no topsoil. You cannot have a civilization without topsoil and rain. You can have sort of a bubble that some people live in, but not a civilization. It's not doable. Am I saying that the idea that you can terraform Mars is a complete pipe dream that will never happen? No. But it's probably 1,000 years to do it. And he knows that. Because we owe everything to dirt and rain. And I know there's a difference between soil and dirt, but you get my point. If we don't have fertile soils that will produce food, I'm a carnivore. And what does your food eat? If we don't have a functioning carbon and water cycle, we will all eventually perish. There should be more focus right now on preserving and rebuilding the systems that provide food for the world than anything else we do. Because our existence depends upon it. Not bad for an old radio host, huh? That dude has many things that he said that were just fantastic. And that to me is among the best. I also loved his old, I don't know if you ever heard it, we won't get into it today, but he had his soliloquy one time about how life was better when most people lived on dirt roads. And it was like, you know, at the end of dirt roads, there's people with shotguns and dogs that bite, but they'll help you. But we don't have crime at the end of dirt roads because there's dogs that bite and people will shoot you. I'm paraphrasing. Moving on, Bill Mollison. This is one of my favorite quotes that anybody's ever made. Though the problems of the world are increasingly complex, the solutions remain embarrassingly simple. I've talked about that one a lot in the past, so I don't know how deep I'll go into it, its own meaning today. I want you to compare that, though, to where we started out. With the iron law of bureaucracy, the theory of stupidity, and Bunk Mr. Fuller saying if you want to change something, build a new model, don't fight the old one. Think about that in relation to this. The solutions to our problems are embarrassingly simple, especially when we look at something like what we just talked about from Paul Harvey. We owe all life, everything that we have, to 6 inches of topsoil and the fact that it rains. So if we want to preserve humanity in the future, if we want prosperity for all, then we should focus on the thing that feeds everybody. It's embarrassingly simple. And fixing the soils, easy. When I say easy, I don't want to oversimplify. But what I mean by easy is we have the knowledge of exactly what to do and how to adjust the things that we do based on climate, weather pattern, soil type. Like, there's nothing we don't know when it comes to what we need to do to make soil more productive, hold more water, cycle more carbon, restore the water cycles. Like, we know how to do everything. We really do. I didn't say we know how to do it perfectly, and I didn't say there's nothing to learn. But we know enough to fix all the arable land and make a lot of land that we don't think of as arable, arable. We know enough to restore entire ecosystems. We know enough to restore entire watersheds. That makes it embarrassingly simple. So why don't we? Because the existing paradigm has no interest in it. It doesn't benefit them. How do you become wealthy? You control something that's scarce. That's how you become wealthy. When I say wealthy, I'm not talking like Jack Spirko wealthy, right? Having my nice little farm and not worrying about money. I don't mean that. I don't mean the guy down the street that you know that owns 3 real estate properties and is a lawyer and has some decent money and his kids go to private school. No. When I say wealthy in this context, I'm talking about people who have so much money that it's almost sinful the amount of wealth and power that they have. You know, we're talking about the people that are, you know, multiples of billionaires. How do you become that wealthy? You control something that is scarce, or you create an artificial scarcity in something that you control. The De Beers family is the perfect example. Diamonds are not scarce. Diamonds are not rare. Diamonds are incredibly common. They're just geographically scarce. Most of the diamonds in the world come from a very few places, but there's so many diamonds that there's no reason for, you know, a beautiful 1.5-carat diamond to be worth $10,000 or whatever they're worth. None. There is a place in South Africa that looks like a big stone quarry, because it's basically what it is, that you can take a metal bucket and about 100 foot of rope, tie it around the bucket, throw it over, drag the bucket up the side of the thing, dump it out and sort through it, and you'll find tons of diamonds in it. It'll be like 10% decent diamonds that can be cut. Guess who owns it? De Beers. So what did De Beers do? They got control of the supply, and then they control the issuance, the release. And in doing so, they create an artificial scarcity, and you have one of the wealthiest families that's ever existed. Where's the biggest wealth concentration at? Banks. Do you think that banks and bankers are wealthy because you put your money in their bank? No. That's amateur thinking. No, banks are wealthy because they literally create money. They print money at will, but they create an artificial scarcity to it that makes you exchange your labor for it. And your promise to expend your labor and repay a loan allows them to loan you money that they don't even have out of thin air. It's called fractional reserve banking. If you want to get wealthy, extremely wealthy, control something that is scarce or create artificial scarcity in something that is abundant and control the supply, and you will be incredibly wealthy. And that's why the solutions are embarrassingly simple, yet not implemented. How many people lose? Now, the American people win. The world wins. The farmers win. The average person wins. If we restore our farm soils to 2 to 3% organic matter, we restore our watersheds to something that actually completes the water cycle, we restore the microbes and the fungi in our soils, and we cut down our farm inputs by 90%, which is totally doable within a decade, by the way. Totally. We all win. Who loses? Syngenta loses. Bayer loses. ConAgra loses, right? Now, a lot of people that don't lose think they lose, so they stay part of the consortium. You know, John Deere and Husqvarna probably think they lose, but they don't lose. Farmers would still use giant mechanized pieces of equipment. They would just do something else with it. But so entrenched is this mindset. I'll tell you a story. It had to be 14-ish years ago. A group of people out of Austin, actually out of Carrollton, Texas, but they were working with the government in Austin, had this wonderful idea. They were going to put together this business percolator, and they were going to recycle garbage in a bunch of different ways. Like, some of the garbage would make gas and fertilizer. Some would be more like, you know, recycling aluminum and things like that. And there was a bunch of other things going on with it. And they were doing a presentation for the Austin City Council, and they asked me to come in. There's a video of it somewhere, actually, of like something that I gave them a close for the council. And it's me saying the close, and I don't even remember what it was, right? And I followed up with them and said, how'd the meeting go? They said, well, the meeting seemed to go really well, but the project's dead. What do you mean the project's dead? You know who killed it? The garbage men, the people that ran the sanitation companies. They're literally mafia. And they basically said, you know, you need to stop doing what you're doing or something bad's going to happen to you guys. And so, you know, the guy that was behind it is a guy named John. And he told him, he said, listen, this doesn't affect you at all. Instead of taking the garbage to the landfill, you take the garbage here, you get the same money for it. And they were told again, if you keep doing this, something bad's going to happen to you guys. Why? Because anything that upsets the paradigm is considered risk to the people benefiting from the paradigm. And that's why it is easy to solve these problems. But the natural reaction from a person with a modicum of thought is, if it's so simple, why are we doing it? Because the system's purpose is what it does. What does the agricultural system do right now? It harnesses the labor and risk of the farmer to feed the peasant at the enrichment of the people in the middle, which is the purpose of the system. Think of how many people are employed with bullshit jobs that are unnecessary in that system. Look at the medical system. What is the medical system supposed to do? Make sick people well. Well, I got an idea. It's freaking crazy. It's a crazy idea. If the purpose of the system is supposed to be to make people well, then why don't we start with things that would make less people sick? So the people that are in the system and sick will consume less resources, and therefore our doctors and nurses and healthcare providers will be able to do a better job helping the actual sick people get better instead of maintaining the sickness of the people who are made sick by their own lifestyle. That's insanity. But is it not dramatically simple? You know, I won't say keto or carnivore is the way to be. Just don't eat fucking sugar. Like, if the average American was just told, look, don't eat sugar, and even your complex carbohydrates, don't eat more than 100 grams of carbohydrates a day. And if that became the standard, and most people did it, like half, at least, of our chronic illness would vanish. It would completely vanish. Who is harmed by that? Ozempic. Right? Which, by the way, those people are about to get the shit sued out of them. You're about to see the largest class action lawsuit you've ever seen in your life, but yet we'll do it all over again because the purpose of the system is what it does, not what it claims to do, even though our solutions are embarrassingly simple. It is embarrassing because we refuse to do it. But if we're going to do it, we just go do it for ourselves. We fix our own bodies. We fix our own minds. We fix our own spirits. We fix our own land. That's what we can do. We build a new system that obsoletes the old one. And if it takes seven generations, then you better get your ass started. All right. My next one. This is one that a lot of people take issue with. And Jeff is probably my biggest mentor in the world of permaculture. Speaking of Jeff Lawton here, he is somebody I have tremendous respect for. I've had the great pleasure to work with him on quite a few things. So, you know, I'm naturally defensive of my mentor, but I also understand what he's saying here. Jeff Lawton once famously said, all the world's problems can be solved in a garden. And when you say that, especially on a show about preparedness, especially early on before I laid the groundwork of a lot of what we teach today, I got a lot of people saying, oh, Jack, you think you can fix everything just by having a garden. But if you have a garden, you're broke. You're still broke. Yeah, you are. See, I think people are taking that statement by Lawton way too surface level, way too much of a surface level statement. It's not like you plant a garden, all the problems in the world will go away. All the world's problems can be solved in a garden. On the surface, if we start there, people will kill each other when they don't eat. So if we can produce food that's healthy and relatively cheap or affordable or freely available, we'll have less conflict. Less conflict goes a long way to solving a lot of the world's problems. Not all of them, but a lot of them. It's a big bite right out of it by taking it to surface. But think about being in a garden. Not, you know, 2 4x4 raised beds in the back of somebody's yard who just started. A really beautiful garden. Sometimes somebody's put some effort into over years. You know, think of a garden at like an urban scale food forest type of garden. A place where it's not just vegetables and fruits, but water features and frogs, butterflies, and dragonflies. And when you're sitting there in the morning listening to the world wake up and the birds chirping and the water flowing, and you know that your food is right there and your friends are over there, and that you do not have to worry about eating, and you want to solve the problem, what better place could you be to think about how to solve the problem? See, that's what Jeff was really saying. And I can say that confidently because when I asked him if that's what he was saying, he said, right, that's what I'm saying. So there you go. Okay. We can solve all the world's problems in a garden because the garden is beautiful. It's productive. And if we do it right, it's perennial, not in plant type, but in the fact that it's constantly rejuvenating. And that's how we need to build our own civilizations. It doesn't mean we will. Or that if you plant a garden, you solve the world's problems for yourself. It means that if you want a place to think about solutions to problems, that a beautiful garden is the place to go. And at the same time, you get to feed yourself and your family and your neighbors the best quality food in the world. All the world's problems can be solved in a garden. The next one, and the last one, I definitely wanted a quote from Albert Einstein in this. The problem is, much of what you hear that Albert Einstein famously said, there is no record that he ever said. You know the one about education? See, I love the one about education. I would love to know who actually said it first, instead of who that was falsely attributed to Einstein, that if you judge a fish based on its ability to climb a tree, it appears to be an idiot, right? But he never said that. He did say this, though, and it's interesting. It's a Reddit page. I have links to learn more about all of these quotes today in the show notes, but this was a Reddit post, and it was, "Great spirits have always encountered violent opposition from mediocre minds." And several of the people, because Reddit is a garbage dump, but it's also a place with thinking people. So going to say it doesn't feel very Einstein-y, probably a Bruce Lee quote or maybe Mark Twain. No, this actually was. You know, source doesn't sound like Einstein at all. More like someone enlightened by his own intelligence, maybe Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yeah, no. Good Guy 9 here actually has the full backstory, which I vetted and found out to be true. The full quote is thus: "Great spirits have always encountered violent opposition from mediocre minds. The mediocre mind is incapable of understanding the man who refuses to bow blindly to conventional prejudices and chooses instead to express his opinions courageously and honestly," end quote. Einstein, in a letter to Morris Raphael Cohen, March 19, 1940. It was a letter defending Bertrand Russell's appointment to a university position. The great-spirited subject Einstein is referring to is Bertrand Russell, who famously uprooted the foundations of logic and helped rewrite modern philosophy. He was saying that while Russell is unorthodox, he is more than smart enough to be hired into the university position. Great spirits have always encountered violent opposition from mediocre minds. Boy, you know, I hate using COVID as a crutch for the points that I try to make. But boy, it exposed so many of these things to be real, didn't it? Wasn't there violent opposition for mediocre minds to great spirits who said, this isn't what you think it is. You don't have to be afraid. There are solutions. This thing doesn't work that they say works. This thing they say works is probably dangerous. This thing they say is dangerous either works and isn't dangerous or at least isn't dangerous. Weren't they violently opposed? More people locked up for going to the wrong place the wrong way at the wrong time? Weren't we told to stay in our homes? Didn't we have our businesses violently shut down? Didn't the people that say, I'm not doing this, incur the wrath of the state? Weren't great spirits attacked, right? Violently opposed? And weren't the people doing the opposing very mediocre minds? But then we also have to look at something at a higher level. That's a surface level look at that quote. But what is a mediocre mind to someone like Albert Einstein? I mean, what I think of as a mediocre mind, right, is pretty weak. Einstein probably would have thought my mind was pretty mediocre. I can accept that, right? We're talking about a dude with like 185 IQ or some shit. Okay, great. I've said often, you know, if you have 140 IQ, when you're dealing with somebody with an average IQ of 100, you feel like a person with a 110 IQ dealing with an actual retard, because you're like, get there. I'm already there. Get there, right? But by mediocre mind, what Einstein was talking about is a totally different level. Being willing to break dogma and stretch to the next point. See, we already have the problem that we see today in science and medicine, right, and government. When you have an established orthodoxy in any organization, your iron law bureaucracy, we bookend and come back to. You have professors who have written textbooks that are in colleges all over the country that they have a giant royalty check that comes in from a captive system. Do you think that person is willing to listen honestly and openly about the fact that their entire theory was wrong? Do you think the professor that didn't even expose the theory, but just taught it for 20 years, has any interest in saying, for 20 years, I taught people the wrong fucking thing? You think so? I don't. It is a non-mediocre mind that will be able to look beyond where we are and see where we could be. And this will always be violently opposed. And this is a constant in the human condition. Like I said at the beginning, none of this is new. There is an evolutionary component to this. People that are like, oh, what's that over there? And they go out and check something out without caution. The people that charge in, a lot of them early on, before we understood a lot of things, died. Huh, look, there's a dead creature that we've been eating out there, but there's some movement in the bushes. Let me go see what it is. Chomp! Right? So caution. The people that became in charge of tribal groups were both aggressive and cautious. Hey, this is a new thing. We should be afraid of it. Sometimes you should be afraid of a new thing. Sometimes you should embrace a new thing. Balance is the hard thing. Like, how do I examine the new thing, trial the new thing, protect myself, but see if the new thing benefits me? It takes a non-mediocre mind to think that way. Look at the violent opposition to people like Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson. It's one thing to say I don't agree with them. Why are they violently attacked? You know, if you read the book I keep mentioning, 1491, America Before Columbus, you'll see the same pattern. There were archaeologists that were literally calling for all archaeologists to take any of the amateur archaeologists that's saying, hey, we're finding things that are older than you say people were here. And literally the word is violently attack them. Shut down the quacks before they infect the common minds. Mediocre minds are always violently attacked. I'm sorry. Great spirits are always attacked by mediocre minds. And so when you find yourself being attacked, you know, try to not be arrogant and think that automatically means that you're thinking beyond what others are capable of thinking, but you might be. But the bigger lesson is whenever you go 1% outside of the orthodoxy, you should expect to be attacked. Do it anyway. And that's why you can't do it inside a system that's designed to do what it does, which is prevent you from changing it. The only way these systems evolve, there's a little bit of evolution in them. They slowly evolve over time, these bureaucracies, is when the old guard retires and dies. And then the middle ground who's been held back, for a moment, but what happens? The middle guard becomes the old guard and does the same thing to the new middle guard, who does the same thing to the new entrance into it. But who should be the ones that are most likely to be expanding our understanding of these difficult things? The young. The people with less preconceptions is the way. Like, I educated to the point of I understand why everybody believes this. But I'm still willing to go outside the norm. In the end, I really want you to take this as my final message to you today. And I don't know if you've ever heard it quite put like this. I've never put it like this before, though I've said different versions of it. You control only what you control. That I know you've heard me say. Well, here's the next part of it. Most people think that's not enough. When you talk like I'm doing today, when you tell people, you know, these are rules for how society works, and you're not going to change them from the inside. You have to go over and be a rebel and make little tiny improvements. To the point where enough people do it that we drag society with us. Like, it feels very disempowering. So when I tell you, you only control what you control, and then you think about, well, what do I really control? The reason you feel like that's not enough is because of where your mind is. Your mind is on all the things you don't control instead of all the things you do control. Stephen Covey, right? I could have included him today. Circle of control and circle of influence. Right, and circle of concern. Most people spend the vast majority of their life in their circles of concern where they have no control. They don't even have much or any influence. And their life, therefore, is wasted. Their dash burns from both ends and gets shorter and shorter until they're in a box. And they never actually change anything in the world, no matter how hard they try. Just like the fly that I started this show talking about, the fly in the window. He had a week to live. He lived 48 hours. In a window, pushing on the glass. Sadly, that's how most people live their lives. But here's the rest of this. but it's more than most can handle. Simply doing the most you can with what you do control is more than most people ever could do. You have so many mechanisms of controlling things in your life. You have so much you could be doing. You have so much impact you could be making. Your potential is bigger than your time. Your potential is greater than your time here. You have a potential to do so much with the limited aspects of what you control if you fully worked those things only. If you ignored all the noise, all the static, all the bullshit, and focused only on the signal, you have a monumentous, lifelong series of tasks ahead of you that could impact the world in incredible ways, but most people won't. And it's weird. It's weird. It's because they don't think what they can do is big enough to matter. So they spend their time worrying about things they don't control. It's the greatest deception that's ever been pulled on humanity. And why would they want to do that? You know, whenever I say they, people are like, who are they? There's no they. There's only people. Yeah, if you don't think there's a they, you have never read a fucking history book that you actually comprehended in your life. They are the people that tell you you will give them a tribute of your income or they will put you in jail, and they will. And most of the people that will do the actual coming out, getting you and putting you in the jail are not they. They're the minions of they. And the people that control society love. They love you focusing on things you don't control. Because there's 300 plus million people in there, something like 330 million, probably like 340 million now with all the new arrivals, right? 340 million people in this country. What is 10% of that number living the way that we're talking about look like to the power elite? That's 34 million people laser focused only on shit that they can control, trying to solve problems that they define for themselves. Because what might be a big problem for me, something I feel like I want to work on, you might have a total, that's fine. There's more problems than there are people, right? So the fact that you're working on problem B and I'm working on A, and Bill's working on problem Z, and Stymie here is working on problem XYZ, and you know, Bonnie Blue is working on problem 123ABC, like, that's fine. That's great. But it is a total disruption. It would be the most disruption that the status quo has ever felt. 10% of people focused only on what they control, doing what they can to solve problems. Ignoring all the people that say they can't, all the people that won't say it doesn't work, right? Remember the old proverb? Those who say a thing that can't be done should not get in the way of the people actively doing it. Yeah? I think that's a Chinese proverb, right? If we had 34 million people in America doing that, the road to anarchy would not be very long. Real anarchy, not the crap they talk about on TV with, you know, teenagers in black suits throwing friggin' Molotov cocktails. That's not anarchy. Anarchy is where society evolves to such a point that the need for rulers is dissolved into obsolescence. That's what it is. That's what real anarchy is. Anarchy is a society rising to such a state with such maturity that it drives rulers into obsolescence. Is it possible? I don't know, but it's worth shooting for, isn't it? Whatever we would come up with is better than what we have. If we can come up with any way to solve problems that are currently not solved, by the way, that doesn't involve stealing from people and using force on people, then it's better. Then it's better. If it does as good a job at addressing the problem without force and theft, then it's better. It could be equal and still be better because we remove force, right? And coercion and theft. But it's not going to happen in your lifetime. You're an ant. Think of yourself more as a bee than an ant for this. A bee in its entire life will make a little thimble full of honey. But all the bees working together will fill the whole hive up. And the bee knows its purpose. Let me tell you what your purpose is not. It's a good way to figure out what your purpose is. Your purpose is not to be a pawn in the system. Your purpose is not to be an obedient slave. Your purpose is not to be controlled by people you don't even know, that don't even know you and don't even know your name and don't give a shit about you. Your purpose is not to sit at a desk 9 hours a day doing bullshit that wouldn't matter if you didn't do it. And I know some of you do that kind of thing, and like, well, there is a thing you do in the company, and the comp. But if the company, you work for went away, nothing would really happen. So it doesn't matter what, no matter how important you are to that company, if the company's not necessary to society, then neither are you in your occupation. I'm not putting you down. I'm not saying quit your job or get away anyway. I'm just saying that's not your purpose. Your purpose is to find a place where your talent and your passion and your ability to provide for yourself overlap in a Venn diagram. And then design a path for yourself that keeps you in that point as much as possible. And if you do that, you won't feel like you have to work a day in your life. You really won't. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up because the eclipse is coming. Hunter asked earlier, when is the eclipse? I believe it starts in about 20 to 25 minutes here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area where we start to have some darkening, and boy, the clouds are coming in. I feel bad for the people. It's like, I think this is interesting, but it's not a big deal to me. But there's like a bunch of people from the TSV audience that like they're meeting down in Midlothian, Texas. Some of them flew in. Tom, my web guy, was here this weekend and hung out with us, and he's down there. And I really hope for those people that it's like a life event for that they get a good visual with it. But I do want to watch you with my kiddos. I think it'll be fun. If nothing else, it will get really dark and cooler out. Hey, by the way, you know the genius on Fox News? I can't think of his name. He's like a blonde-haired guy, good-looking younger guy. He's like an anchor in the morning. My wife turned it on to see what was going on this morning. And he was talking about it. He's talking to this girl. He's like, I'm an amateur meteorologist, and I really get into all this stuff. But you just said that when the eclipse happens that it gets cooler and the wind blows. I don't understand how that works. Open your refrigerator, stupid. These are the people you're trusting. These are the people that you're trusting. Stop trusting them. Anyway, I want to get wrapped up for the eclipse as we do that. Let's go ahead and remind you here at the end, if you like the show and the work that we do, you can help support us by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. And I got an item of the day for you today that totally is useful for what its intended purpose is, but it has like 100 other uses. This is from Vivor. It's called polyester pool tape, but we had a name for it in the telco industry. I'm sure many of you that have been contractors of one type or another are familiar with this stuff. We called it mule tape. And we called it mule tape because you could literally hold back a mule, like a mule will drag you down the street before it'll break. This stuff is strong, but it's not just strong. And what it's mainly used for, like its intended purpose, is you put it in conduits and you attach cables and you pull cables into conduit with it. So like when we were putting in a tremendous amount of fiber optic cable in Dallas-Fort Worth at one point, and we would, you know, put 1,000 foot of conduit in the ground, and then we'd pull a cable of like 24 strand single mode fiber into it. And this is the stuff that we use. And obviously, you got a lot of money on the line. You don't want shit that breaks. So this works wonderful for its intended purpose. But you know what else it is? It's soft. It's supple. And it's flat. And it's wide. And it has a little bit of stretch in it. And you know what it's wonderful for? Your garden. When you're tying up vines, like squash vines and tomatoes and things like that, where a lot of times whatever you tie them up with can cut into the vine, this won't do it. It's like a little hammock. It's also a really great, very strong form of cordage. And you do have to know like what knots to use and what knots not to use. Knots not to use. Because like some real basic knots may not hold well. But when you use a good knot, it has incredible knot strength. 1,800 pound. And there's even a 2,500 pound roll if you want a little bit more. But 1,800 pounds will hold up any squash that I'm going to grow. I love this stuff. And my buddy David and I use it all the time in the gardens. And what we've always said about it is it's like, oh, it's hard to find. Like, unless you have like an account with like Graybar or Annixter or something, you just don't go down to the store and find this stuff on the shelf. So when I saw Vivor had it, I was like, I wonder how expensive it is. And you get like 300 foot, a little more than 300 foot for like $26. So my rep from Vivor is on vacation right now. I could have gotten a roll of this for free if I waited for her to come back. I just ordered a spool of it for myself because I use this to do things like coming off my trellises when the squash vines take too much up, like train them up into trees and stuff like that. Again, tying up peppers and tomatoes and things like that as well. It just doesn't cut into the plant. And cordage is a prepper need. This is some of the strongest, best cordage you can get. I wouldn't advise you to do it all the time or anything, but I mean, you could pull a car with this stuff, especially the 2,500 pound rated stuff. There's a link in the video notes below, or if you are listening to the audio, just go to episode 3475. If you are watching the video, there's a link down there. It will go over to those audio notes. As soon as I get the audio side up, you're watching it live. We're not done yet. And a ton of really cool links and information about everything we covered today will be there. Take care, guys. Enjoy the eclipse if you're in the path of it. And remember, if you look at it without protection over your eyes, it can blind you seriously and even permanently. So there's my little PSA for the day. I'll catch you tomorrow with another episode.
Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. Show you a better way.